Thank you very much. As everybody else has given themselves a little biography, I'll just make a couple of additions, not to repeat my rather shorter biography than either of the two speakers, but just to tell you where my own interests lie in this area, just so to be very upfront about the imperative for me. It's very nice to think of myself as an economic geographer. I think it's much fairer to say that I used to be an academic, and now I just spend my time in my administrative and managerial role, which is a matter of great regret for me. The first thing to say is that my concern as a university leader is primarily to promote the profile of my university. So, like all universities, we strive to excellence. And so I have a major interest in ensuring that the University of Birmingham and UK science in general are as excellent as they can be. And part of that is about ensuring that our research is as widely read as it possibly can be. Secondly, and importantly, it is important to us that this is done in a financially sustainable way. So as I talk through some of the challenges around implementation over the next few minutes or so, then there are huge challenges for us in terms of how we do this in a sustainable way, and the challenges for you as an industry that are going to be felt very differently. And I think, as Janet said, one of the things that was really gratifying while we were working together on the Finch Group was an acceptance and an understanding that although our material interests were very different, it was absolutely in our interest to make sure that we reached a common set of recommendations, because it's clearly not satisfactory for the universities not to be able to afford what we do. But we rely very heavily on the high-quality journals in order to assess research quality. So there is not, I don't believe that there's necessarily a huge conflict between universities and publishers. And I should just say, and I'm only saying this because Bob's in the front and he used to know him, but my father was a publisher as well, so quite some time ago. So I have some feeling for, I certainly used to have some feeling for the rhythms and needs of the publishing industry. So the first two slides are to a degree repetitive of both the first two sets, so I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on them. But I do want to emphasise a couple of things in the context of the UK. But these are not simply confined to the UK. They are global movements, and I think we ignore them at our peril. In the context of the UK, as you know, we have a very peculiar position at the moment where we have a coalition government. This coalition government can agree on some things, not everything, and they're quite public in their disagreements. And again, that's something that's a little unusual in Britain. But one thing they can agree on is that openness is a good thing. There is a major push to transparency, and again, Janet mentioned this, a major push to transparency across the UK publicly funded sector, across government, across charities that are funded by government, and across the university sector. At the macro level, at government level, this plays itself out in the form of a very, very powerful but not very well-known committee called the Transparency Board. And the Transparency Board is chaired by, again, a very influential government minister. And the imperative for the Transparency Board is to ensure that government departments and local government give away as much of their data, and publish as many of the minutes as possible of what they do. For the UK university sector, this plays out in a slightly different way, because we have our own individual body which reports through to the Transparency Board, and this is known as, not surprisingly, it's known as the Research Sector Transparency Board. And the Research Sector Transparency Board is there to ensure that we as a sector, as research, universities and other research organisations sorry, my watch is going all over the place, comply as much as possible with the overall imperative. And this is chaired by the Minister for University and Skills, David Willetts, and I'm a member of the Research Sector Transparency Board, but we haven't yet met. It's taken us quite some time to meet, but we meet later on in February. And again, as Janet mentioned, transparency is seen to be in the public interest, and it plays out for universities in two ways. We're talking about open access today. There is also a parallel and very powerful movement towards opening up research data as well. And again, this is going to be a huge challenge for the university sector for a range of reasons. Cost is clearly one of them. So were we to retain all of the data that are produced at CERN, for example, even the less than 1% of data that aren't thrown away straight away, if we were to retain that all, it would be very expensive for us if we were expected to do it individually. But there are also issues around data, such as the intellectual property that we believe that we retain in some of the data, but the government doesn't accept that we have intellectual property in data. So there are issues around that, which again, over lunch, I'm very happy to talk about some of the challenges around that. But the primary political driver is, as mentioned by both of my predecessor speakers, that the public who fund the research should have a right to have unimpeded access to that research. And it is worth stressing, in the context of the United Kingdom, that we have had policies on open access for a very, very long period of time. So Arnoud mentioned that you've been talking about open access in these discussions for years and years and years. The research funders in the UK have required us to put things into open access form for equally as a longer period. And I have to say, the simple truth is we just haven't done it. Universities just have not complied with that mandate. And in my own university, the University of Birmingham, we currently only have around 800 articles in our repository, our institutional repository, which is a small fraction of the number of papers that we publish every year. And given the repository has been running for around a decade, it is actually, it's trivial. And it is something that is not acceptable, either for me as a research manager, but primarily for the government bodies that fund our research. And again, just to be clear, that isn't an issue to do with problems from publishers. It is primarily because we really struggle to get academics to take the issue seriously. And in fact, the manager of our digital repository is here today, and it's not Tracy's fault that we haven't got a fully populated repository. It's because academics have just simply refused to take it seriously as an issue. So this is essential that we make a move. And finally, and because both previous speakers have mentioned this, I won't mention the other imperative, which is open access is seen as a mechanism for promoting innovation and growth. The truth is, the evidence for this is a little thin, but it is a truth that's believed by important players, and so sometimes the discourse is actually more important than the underlying economic reality. So what I don't intend to do is spend a lot of time repeating what Janet said in much greater detail about the Finch Working Group, and please don't for a minute believe that Janet doesn't understand anything about open access. It is her characteristic modesty which makes her say that rather than anything else. It's also rather peculiar that Janet has stopped being a person and she started being a report. So people talk about Finch not as a person but as about the outcome of the inquiry. And I have to say, I can't even remember what the title of our report was, so I refer to it as the Finch Report. And I'm sure that everybody else who is involved in it, other than Janet, who is actually a real person, does herself. But I do want to emphasise just two or three main points. The first is that we did have a very broad range of stakeholders. This wasn't a mechanism to push through a particular solution that met the interests of that of a particular set of stakeholders. And that's important because when the report was published, it meant that many of our constituencies felt that we'd let them down because we needed to achieve a consensus. And what's been, for me, very interesting in the 6 months or so since the group reported is that there's been a gradual acceptance that actually this was the best possible solution that we could have, even though there, certainly among some of the people I work with in the university sector, even though immediately there was a sense that this was a disaster, I think most people have come around to believe that this was the best possible outcome that we could have ended up with. The second points I wanted to make are very clear because Janet articulated them already, but we specifically go for a mixed model of green open access, and you all know that means unpaid for open access subject to embargo periods, and gold open access where we pay for the privilege of getting immediate access that's unimpeded completely. That we'd pursue publication in open access or hybrid journals, and that critically, and I'll come back to this in a minute, that we would eliminate restrictions or we would seek to eliminate restrictions on rights of use and reuse. And again, this is very important politically in the UK and not university popular among the university sector. That funders should emulate the Wellcome Trust. The Wellcome Trust is an independent charity funded by the sale of a pharmaceutical company. And the Wellcome Trust is a major funder of biomedical research in the UK. And as such, they can determine the policies that they wish to pursue. They're not subject to the democratic mandate. And consequently, they are able to say to us, if you want to accept money from us, you must comply with our policies and publish in a particular form. But they do pay us for it, and they pay us fully for the costs of all the APCs arising from Wellcome Trust research. And as Janet said, it doesn't cover scholarly monographs. I continue to get people in the humanities particularly asking me about this, and it's a very simple answer. I have to say, at the other end, I get people in the sciences saying to me, well, why should people in the humanities and the social sciences get be covered and allowed to keep their royalty income when you, as a research university, expect to have access to the intellectual property they generate through the patents? But my view about this is it's a big fight for a very small gain, so there's no point in going into it. So what I want to do is I really want to spend most of my time talking about what's happened in the 6 months or so since we reported. The first thing that happened is the Department of Business, Industry and Skills, which is the sponsoring body for the university and research sectors in the United Kingdom, immediately embraced the Finch recommendations. They also have subsequently gone slightly further, so they support the UK Publishers Association decision tree. And if you haven't seen this, I'm not sure whether it's going to come up later on today, but if you haven't seen it, it's definitely worth taking a look at, because the decision tree gives a lot of nuance, and it should give a lot of comfort both to people in the university sector who are very worried about what implementation is going to look like, but also for publishers who are worried about the sustainability of implementation. Because the decision tree effectively says, if there are funds available, we go down the gold route. If there are not funds available, then we look at what the embargo period looks like and so on. So it is a nuanced approach. And really, the person to talk to is Bob Campbell, if it's not going to come up elsewhere today and you don't know it. There is a very strong preference for gold open access because it is immediate, but also, and importantly, because of the associated CC BY or CC BY licenses that come with gold open access. And again, this is going to be a bit of a challenge. I'm sure you're all familiar with CC BY licenses, but what it means is there can be no further restrictions imposed either by the author or the publisher on the reuse of the research paper, and that would include things like data mining. So it really is a very radical opening up of what is the traditional model for the license. And we would expect, I have to say, we would expect this not to come at additional cost. And again, this is something of an area of some concern in some areas of the forest. And I also wanted to stress that as Janet said, the government is investing some resource to assist universities to make the transition. There's the £10 million that we were immediately announced, and then, as I'll say in a minute, the research councils have also found some funding. The other really important player, as I mentioned, was the Wellcome Trust. The Wellcome Trust has been, for many years, a major innovator and supporter of open access, and they're in the process of strengthening their approach. They already require deposit in PubMed Central within 6 months of publication. So that's effectively a six-month embargo for green papers. And from April this year, they will require a CC BY license to be associated with the research that they fund. Again, this is a significant shift in terms of the licensing model, which I think you all need to be aware of if you're not already. So the two major players are the research councils. The two main players in funding are the research councils and the funding councils, and I'll talk about both of those separately. The research councils are seven independent bodies which come together under an umbrella body known as Research Councils UK or RCUK, and they are the main funders in the UK of competitively won research grants. The research councils have announced a policy, or they announced a policy again very shortly after Janet's group reported, that require that papers that they fund must be submitted to journals which either have a gold option or allow a short embargo for green open access. Now, what does short embargo mean? When they publish their initial policy, short embargo means 6 months, other than for humanities and social science disciplines, where it means 12 months. There is a bit of movement on that, and I'll come on to talk about that very shortly. But furthermore, the research councils require that these journals allow a CC BY license where an APC is paid. So not for green papers, clearly, but if we're paying for gold open access, then the quid pro quo on the publisher's part, on the journal's part, must be this unrestricted license which allows for data mining and reuse of the publication. That is something that in some academics are very concerned about. I have to say, I think needlessly, but nevertheless, perception really matters in this field. But I believe certainly that most of the major publishers that I've talked to are comfortable with that. But you may tell me differently, because you are most of the major publishers after all. So you may have a very different perspective on that. And the research councils have given us, have said they will provide a block grant in order to allow us to pay for compliance with this policy. The trouble is always the same. The block grant is not enough. So there is again, and I'll come on to talk about this shortly, there is again going to be some movement and some discussion between us as to how we understand and how we implement the research council requirement. The thing I want to stress at the moment, though, is that the initial published position of the research councils of late last summer, is in the process of being rethought. So if you were to go and look at what the Research Council's current policy looks like, it will change, and it may change in quite important ways, as I'll explain in a few minutes. But I wanted to emphasise that, and I'm quoting directly here, the Research Councils now see this as a journey rather than a single event. So the policy for them applies from April the 1st of this year, but they're not seeing April the 1st of this year as a big bang. They're seeing this as the start of a really important process where over a five-year period, we will have made that transition that Janet was talking about from one model, which is largely subscription-based, to another model, which is, in the UK context anyway, largely based upon an open access approach. And I very nearly said an APC-based model, but I don't think that's necessarily going to be the outcome. I think it ultimately will be, but it depends on what happens in the rest of the world. It might be that our open access model will be much greener than gold if it's only the UK that makes these, only the UK and I should say Germany, and but if it's only a small number of countries that make the transition, then the UK is not going to be spending all of our money on paying for APCs for all of our content and then also having to buy the 94% of the residual. That's clearly not a sustainable position for the UK. So during this transition, the research councils fully expect to see flexibility around a whole series of areas, but the most important one is around the area of embargoes. And we heard in the first keynote that there seems to be quite a lot of consensus in Germany around embargo lengths. I wish I could say the same in the United Kingdom. The single most controversial aspect of the implementation of open access in the UK now is around the issue of how long embargoes should be. And that's because very important constituents believe that very short embargoes don't lead to a sustainable financial model. Now, the evidence for that is a little unclear, I have to say, because in the biomedical and life sciences, embargo lengths of 6 months already exist in most areas, partly because of the pressure from the Wellcome Trust and the Medical Research Council and other funders internationally to require a six-month embargo. In the rest of the sciences, it looks as if a six-month embargo may be problematic. And as I said at the beginning, and as Janet emphasised, sustainability for all parties is important to us. And what we don't want to do is require two short embargoes, which means that important journals go under. So there is a lot of controversy around whether 6 months is an appropriate embargo length in the science, in the broad science arena. But even more so, the idea that 12 months is a suitable embargo for the social sciences and the humanities may also turn out to be problematic. Cited half-lives for papers in the social sciences can be very long. And the journal that I used to edit, Transactions of the Institute of British Geographers, the cited half-life for that journal was about 5 years. So there are legitimate questions as to whether 12 months is the right period for an embargo length for the humanities and social sciences. And so at the moment, the research councils have signalled that there will be flexibility around embargo lengths. And what I would hope and expect is that we'd see 6 months in areas where we already have 6 months. I don't think there can be any justification for moving that to a longer embargo period. But then 12 and 24 may be suitable compromises for the other two, for other sciences and humanities and social sciences. Finally, I wanted to emphasise that the research councils have committed to conducting a review of their policy after 12 months of their being implemented. So in other words, in April 2014, the research councils will be doing a review. The Finch Group will also be conducting a review over the summer, as Janet mentioned, and in fact, I had an email this morning lining that up. So clearly we're in the process of numerous reviews around implementation over the next year or so. And I think these will be substantive reviews, which may lead to a change in approach if what we're doing isn't working. So this isn't a settled environment for the research councils. The second group of important funders are the funding councils. And again, I don't need to describe this too much because Janet explained that in the UK we get funded through two streams. Academics apply for competitive research grants from the research councils, and universities get a block grant based upon the overall quality of the research that we do from one of four national funding bodies. The main one is the Higher Education Funding Council for England, HEFCE, and that covers about 85% of the UK population, so it is overwhelmingly the dominant one. But in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, there are separate funding councils for the national territories, and they have slightly different approaches, although I should say their approach to open access will be exactly the same. So this is, if you like, it's the complementary element of funding for university research. The funding councils will say to anybody who would like to listen that they believe there is a strong moral preference for gold forms of open access. But in practice, the funding councils are agnostic because all they can do is they can police us through this rather peculiar mechanism known as the Research Excellence Framework or the REF. This is very boring, but every few years, universities in the United Kingdom are subject to a major audit of the quality of the research that we do. And we are just in the process now of submitting in November our submissions to the current round for the Research Excellence Framework, this audit of research quality. And this audit of research quality determines our funding, and it determines our standing in national and international league tables. It is really important. In order to do that, we submit a whole load of evidence about the impact that we make, but critically, we submit research papers and books published by our academics, and they're judged by independent peers who say this is of a particular quality. I should say, because we're academics, it's a 5-point scale that starts at 0 and ends in 4 because we can't really add up properly. But what's important is that this is based on quality, not volume. So we only submit 4 research outputs per member of staff. So there is no volume driver. And to be honest, as a academic leader, as a university manager, I would prefer somebody over a 5-year period to produce 4 absolutely brilliant pieces of work than 30 pieces of work that are fairly mediocre. It's better for the university, it's better for UK science, and it certainly brings us more money and more kudos. And this has implications for publishing that I will mention in my final comments. So HEFCE can only police this through the REF, but they are not funding us they're not giving us additional money to support open access. They have said that they will adopt the Research Council position on the details of both embargoes and licences. So I think the main game in town is the Research Councils rather than HEFCE in terms of the detail of implementation. They will require us to maintain very strong institutional repositories, and my expectation is that only papers which are in the institutional repository, either through gold or green, will be able to be submitted to the REF in 2020 or 2019, whenever it might be. So that's how it would work. So that's their mechanism for policing. There is, of course, a gathering momentum. It's not just in the UK that these things are going on. We heard in detail about what's happening in Europe earlier on. The position for Horizon 2020, that is assuming that all the money doesn't go on subsidising farmers, is that there will be a strong, there will be an open access requirement. There will be some funds for gold, but there are certainly in the current plans, there are insufficient funds to fund all the gold open access under 2020. So it will be a mix between between a gold and a green road through 2020. The European Research Council we've already heard about, and they already have a strong requirement for open access compliance. We've already again heard about the European Commission's advice to member states, but I want to stress one or two points about that. And the first is that the embargo lengths that the Commission is recommending as advice to member states, so this doesn't have legal status, the embargo lengths that the Commission recommend are less favourable than the emergent UK position. So there is a bit of, I think there will be continuing discussion between the Commission and member states around this. We've heard about the German position. I just picked out the DFG, but there are a series of... clearly, the German position is much more nuanced than that, than just the DFG. Member states from Bulgaria to Ireland are all developing positions on open access. What tends to be the position, as I'm sure you know, is that the poorer member states are going down the green road, but the more the wealthier member states are favouring gold. Given that most research is being done within the better-off member states, I don't see that as necessarily a major problem, because I think the momentum is the most important thing. And I should say I have an almost daily correspondence at the moment with a journalist in France who's trying to understand what's happening in the UK in order to, presumably because there are moves going on in France that I'm unaware of. So this is something that is happening across Europe. And again, we maybe should have coordinated this, but the position in Science Europe is really important. It's the umbrella body for the research councils and some major research organisations on the continent. Critically, it is worth you noting that the chair of Science Europe at the moment is the chief executive of the British Economic and Social Research Council, one of the seven research councils in the UK. And Paul Boyle is very strongly, personally committed to ensuring that open access and a UK-style open access is pursued as vigorously as is conceivable. I think Science Europe will be a very important player in this. And again, if the aim is ultimately to replace the subscription model with an APC model for research in Europe. I really don't intend to spend much time talking about the position in the rest of the world. You will have noted probably more acutely than I did the very strong and very hostile response from the American and international scientific community to the proposed Research Works Act. Again, I think that the territory that you tread is actually much more dangerous territory in some ways than the territory that I tread as a university manager. But I think if there's another approach like that, then it will be very dangerous to the continued maintenance of subscription-based models. And as I said at the beginning, I require, in order to understand what is good in a large university, I really do need to look at journals as proxies for quality. So if the main journals are boycotted out of existence, then that is a real problem for me, and clearly a real problem for you. But also recently, in the last week or so, the National Institutes of Health have said that they expect their mandate to be complied with. I said at the beginning that the University of Birmingham only has 800 articles in our repository. It is also the case that the NIH, National Institutes for Health, have had for a long period a requirement that research they fund is put into PubMed Central or another form within 6 months, and the compliance levels are risible. The NIH has now said that academics who don't comply with their policy cannot get any further funding from the NIH, and that will have a transformational, or if it doesn't have a transformational effect on academics, then they'll find they don't get any research funding. And then we see similar developments in Australia, New Zealand, and so on and so forth. The other point I wanted to emphasise, and I'll pick up on the comments of Eric at the beginning when he said that publishers are needed, and I think there is a general acceptance that publishers are needed, but the same publishers are not necessarily needed. The challenge for you, I think, is to ensure that the journals that you publish are able to flourish in a very different model. So the PLUS Group, I have to say, the PLUS One started out as a journal that was the, not to be pejorative, but the dump for places where people couldn't get published elsewhere. We're now in a situation where the PLUS family are extremely good set of journals, and that's been over a very short period of time. So, you know, the emergence of new journals will and is destabilising a particular model that we currently exist with. You'll all be aware, and I know that from reading the guest list, that there is somebody here from eLife. eLife is a highly prestigious journal which is supported by Wellcome Trust, Max Planck and Howard Hughes. And I don't know whether this is explicit, but I certainly know that it is implicit, is eLife is seen by Wellcome Trust as a mechanism to change the model from subscriptions to an APC model. And because it's funded by such important international funders who support some of the best research in the world, I'm absolutely confident that this will become of a status of nature and science within a very short period of time. And then there are new things such as the Episciences Project. Tim Gowers, who I imagine is not the most popular person among some of you, Tim Gowers was one of the people who tried to get the, or led the boycott of Elsevier over the RWA. Tim Gowers announced in the last week or so that he is launching a suite of open access journals across the for the maths community. Now, it may or it may not fly, but it will certainly have some profile. And I just noted that over the weekend, Sage Open, which was set up in order to provide an open access outlet for the social sciences, Sage Open changed the cost of their APC from around $700 to $99 in response to a concern that APCs were set too high initially. And it may easily, and I don't know, and I haven't spoken to Sage about this, but I will do at some point, it may be that they just weren't attracting enough interest at that $700 price point. So, you know, it is a rapidly moving environment, not just in terms of the regulators and the funders, but in terms of the marketplace. And I can't see that this is going to do anything other than speed up rather than slow down. So I'll spend the last 10 minutes or so on exploring how we are implementing the mandate in the UK. The first thing to say is that, and I don't believe these data, but I think I think that we're probably moving in this direction, that Research Libraries UK, which is an umbrella body for the main research libraries in universities and the national libraries of Great Britain and Ireland, estimate that now 40% of UK authored papers are already in an open access form of one sort or another. That we in the university sector are working as hard as we can with our key partners to ensure that implementation of the various mandates that we have can be as smooth, as pain-free, if you like, as possible. There is lots of subterranean dialogue going on at the moment between the government, between the research funders, between the research universities and between the Publishers Association. So we have a meeting in a couple of weeks' time that's being brokered by the minister that involves all of those bodies. And again, what we're not doing is opening up the do we do open access, it's how can we do this most effectively. So how can we implement the mandate? All major universities are, I think, at some speed developing and enhancing our institutional repositories. We are in the process either of requiring or of policing our open access mandates to staff. My university has had for some time a requirement that all of our staff publish all of their work in open access form, so they place their papers in the repository. And as I've said a couple of times, we just don't do it. In a very short period of time, we're going to start policing that. And ways that we can police it would be we won't allow anybody to get promotion or progression if all their papers aren't in the repository, for example. So we can wave sticks around as well as just ask them very nicely to do things. And this is requiring a substantial investment in infrastructure, which is again outwith of all the additional costs we're getting. More generally, there are moves going on within the university sector to develop common processes and to share best practices. The research librarians are very active and providing a lot of support to people like me in terms of doing that. There's a group at Nottingham University which is working on a national support service. There's another body called the UK Open Access Implementation Group, which supports activities such as examining the role of intermediaries in managing the payment of APCs and providing a support pack for learning societies. These are challenges which we haven't yet got a solution to, and I'll talk again very briefly in a minute. And the research libraries are trying to work on monitoring implementation as well. So I'll finish off just by mentioning some of the key challenges that I see for me, and then my final comments will be for you. The first thing I want to say, and is probably implicit in everything that I've already said, is that the landscape for us continues to be a little uncertain. We have reviews that have been announced recently by two separate parliamentary bodies. As you know, well, as I'm sure you do know, in Britain we have a bicameral system. We have the House of Commons, which has primary legislative power, and we have the House of Lords, which has secondary power, and which is really an oversight body. The House of Lords announced a couple of months ago that they were going to conduct a review of the implementation of open access, and they weren't asking questions about whether open access was a good thing. The evidence for that actually is happening today as we speak in the House of Lords, where a range of different stakeholders, ranging from, I have to say, colleagues of mine in universities who are very hostile to the whole approach, right through to people who accept the need for it and to the publishers, are giving evidence to Lord Krebs and his committee today. And I don't know what the outcome of the Krebs review will be. Quite separately, the House of Commons committee, which has responsibility for monitoring our government department, announced a review not just of implementation, but of the policy itself just before Christmas. I don't believe this will lead to a change in the policy, but it is for me a matter of real concern that we're opening up the question again as to whether we should do it. I don't think it will make any difference to the outcome, but I think it is destabilising and very unhelpful in terms of managing a process. And that will be taking evidence over the next few months. The Minister, David Willetts, has said that there will be a ministerial statement on his views later on this week. So I wish I could tell you what he was going to say, but I have absolutely no idea at all, I'm afraid. And finally, the funders, the research councils particularly, have said they will announce a definitive policy on open access towards the end of February. And I think that will be very friendly and favourable, and I think it will be much more nuanced than their original position, which was do it now, don't worry about anything else. I think we're being filmed, actually. I didn't say that. Another key challenge for us is a challenge of affordability. The additional income that we've been given is likely to cover only 10% of the publications in the major research universities. We absolutely accept that we should use some of our unhypothecated funds to support open access, but we can't fund the residual 90%. So that is a real challenge for us. And it means that we do have to think about the transition model rather than just the short-run cost. There is, as I said, additional funding for gold. There is a challenge of how we're going to manage the micropayments. I know some of the publishers are working on this, but we can't be in a position where we effectively negotiate once every 5 years or so the journal subscription prices with major publishers and minor publishers and smaller publishers to one where we have to manage hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of payments on each individual paper. So that model is, I know it's being worked on, but it is a challenge to make sure we can get it right. There is some strong opposition from lobby groups, particularly in the social sciences and the humanities, and that's something that just plays in the politics of the process. And this is coming through in the form of staff compliance. There are lots of members of staff who are very worried about the implications for them. I have to say, my own view is they don't need to be worried. But people believe that if we're not funding gold open access charges, then it means we're hindering their career. And so there's a very strong messaging process for us to in order to ensure that we're very clear that is not the case. And my final slides are just around challenges, I think, that will hit you. The first of them is around the pricing of APCs and the implications for subscription costs. The Research Council position is very clear. They wrote in evidence to the House of Lords, which was published last week, that they said we would expect publishers to introduce differential pricing in the UK to reflect the additional income they're earning through APCs. There is evidence that this is happening already. I would point you to the Royal Society of Chemistry. The Royal Society of Chemistry is a small publisher, learned society, but the Royal Society of Chemistry have said to British universities that we can have APCs up to the cost of the subscription that we pay the RSC. And I have to say that is a very welcome, very positive development, because it means that it is an affordable process. I believe that because we do more science than we buy, that actually it is only part of the solution. But I think in the long run, if there's a shift from consumers of research to producers of research, I don't see there's a huge moral issue around that. Janet mentioned these data again, but the second challenge I think for you is that if your journals aren't compliant, then you will not just lose access to the 6% of research that's done from the UK, but you'll lose access to the, unambiguously, the best research sector in the world. And that's not just a bit of UK chauvinism. It's an evidence-based piece of work done by Elsevier about 18 months ago when they demonstrated that on everything but volume and on intellectual property, the UK research is the most productive and the most cited research from any individual research sector in the UK. So if your journals don't comply, you will lose access. And the final point I wanted to make, Fred, I haven't got this because I only thought about it as I was hearing the other two speakers, is that one of the responses on the part of our funders is that we publish in the UK, we publish too much, so that we should publish less and better. And if we do publish less and better, then the challenge for you is to populate your journals with content from elsewhere. I have to say, I don't see that's going to be a problem in the slightest, given the huge investments that are being made in the research infrastructure of Brazil, of China, and of other places in Asia, but of those two countries in particular. That for me is a different kind of challenge, because I don't think we're going to struggle to maintain our strength in research as we don't invest in the same way as they are in the BRICS. And I'll finish there, and thanks very much.